It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast. Welcome to episode 6 of It's Simple, It's Dumb, It's the Podcast, where we talk about Jason Lytle's music with friends and fans of his. Now, I'm even more excited than normal to share this particular episode with you, as it's probably my favorite of the series so far. Today's guest is none other than Kyle Field from Little Wings.
Of my life, it's hard to get these ways out. Plaza cement is so hard. Blisters our skin. Round table, the house bus always pays out. The water gets stuffed up our sleeves. Paper blows off in the breeze. Wizard with a book of spell all hazed up. Spirit badge and wrote it, no doubt. Friday night we'll drink and shout. Oh, why me? So near. What to hope, what to keep. What we cannot clutch or carry. What a leap.
Kyle Field is an artist and an indie folk musician with the band Little Wings, based on the West Coast. He's been friends with Jason for around 25 years, and their careers have had several touch points that we'll discuss in this episode. Now, this is a longer than normal episode, but I just couldn't bear to take out some of these stories that touch upon early granddaddy and their influence upon another aspiring musician. I was floored by the level of detail in Kyle's storytelling, recounting interactions with Jason that occurred in the distant past. It almost felt like I was reading this diary entry from the day he met Jason. If you can't already tell, this episode has me buzzing, and I hope you'll feel similarly after listening. Alright, without any further delay, here's my conversation with Kyle Field of Little Wings.
I would put the year that I first heard about Granddaddy maybe around 96-ish, but I'm not exactly sure, like 1995. I was living in San Luis Obispo. I was a part of a musical scene, if you will, in that town. That was super exciting and formative for someone in their 20s who was in a band that I loved. It was my first band ever, and I started playing music at 19 in that band, essentially, Rodriguez. For you, no trailblazing sights or sounds. Forever in debt, 'cause you let your family down. All right, you want another chance at dancing. But wait for the song to stop. And we had our best and brightest shows in San Luis Obispo immediately when Matt Ward was going to school at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And there was a radio station at the college that was very active and very always an influx of new music and new bands, and they were involved. It was KCPR, it still is. KCPR would be involved in booking so many shows, and it was like kind of probably the one of the zeniths of quote indie rock in America, you know, like coming after the late 80s, but yeah, 90s still were, I guess SST was no longer around, but like there were bands or rather labels like Merge and a lot of the indies that were just kind of like gaining a lot of steam, Sub Pop, blah, blah, blah. And Granddaddy had one tape out, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and I think it was called Complex Party Come Along Theories. And Matt, who's in my band, had seen Granddaddy and Silkworm at Linnea's Cafe, I believe, which was an old brick building that would have shows that were usually in the backyard. And I think Silkworm and Granddaddy had played back there. And Matt had liked Granddaddy, and he kind of had a way of saying they're like the Pixies, or kind of reductivist description, I would say. Sorry, Matt. But I think he said, yeah, they're kind of like the Pixies or something like that, which I don't really like describing music that way. Anyway, they have kind of the loud, quiet approach, so that is Pixies-ish. So I think I heard a few songs on the tape, and it seemed like maybe it was four-track, but it was creatively recorded. So that was interesting, but more interesting, I will just smash cut to the next time I heard about Granddaddy was they were coming to town, and KCPR was booking the show. It was going to be in the backyard at Linnea's, where our band had already played. And, you know, it was kind of customary for a local band to open up for a touring band. And we were going to be opening for Granddaddy. And I was kind of ruminating on this day earlier today, preparing for this, just kind of like the romance of seeing a band for the first time for me in that day and age was almost akin to kind of falling in love or developing some crush. And I think it was in the springtime of all things, like, you know, a little bit of flower scent on the air. And we knew that Granddaddy was at the end of a U.S. tour, which we had toured all of like 5 hours away before. And I put tour in quotes, like the three of us packed into my pickup truck. We were a trio with a camper shell in the back and the gear just crammed to the gills dangerously. And they had just done a U.S. tour. And I don't even think they might have been on some small label. I can't really remember. I didn't know all that much about them, but I was excited to see them live. And I just remember getting there, and we were maybe loading our stuff in, and here's this van parked right in front of the cafe, because maybe they had been there for hours. And I didn't know the ins and outs of touring then at all. I thought that sounded so cool to show up 5 hours before you played and just have to kill time until the club opened or load in or whatever, which now I know is probably the least fun part about touring, but it all mystery seems kind of romantic from a distance. So I just remember they had this kind of ugly van with some Bondo looking thing on the outside of the side of it, which was later explained to me that they had like invented like a homemade air conditioning system, because there was maybe no windows. It was like a cargo van, and they had made this kind of like air catching thing with a filter on the inside, and then they would put like a wet towel in it, if I'm not mistaken. The inside of their van had a couch along one wall, like an ugly brown thrift store couch. There was a shelf up high that kind of obscured the back window with some crates on it with like some canned food and stuff. Like, it looked way more like a camping trip to me than a band. And then, if I'm not mistaken, I guess they must have had a trailer. They were pulling a trailer with their equipment in it. And so I kind of like walk past the van and kind of look in, and there was just kind of like a sunburned blonde guy that looked kind of like in a bad mood, maybe sitting in a weird plastic chair that I don't know if it was from the cafe or if that was thrown in the van too, but they looked kind of rough. Skipping forward to, we didn't talk to them before we played, and then maybe we talked to Jason right after we played. But I remember when we played, I still had not heard them, and looking towards the very back of the patio, and Jason was sitting back there, and I couldn't see his face because his hat was on, and he was just sitting there, and I could tell he was watching our whole set just intently, and that I thought maybe he likes us too. It was that mutual crush kind of feeling. I was like, oh my gosh, man, I think he likes our music. That's cool. And then they played, and it was fantastic. The drums were softer than any band that I had heard at that time. Everything was kind of loud in D-Rock, like your ears would kind of hurt afterwards. And they were ahead of the curve, I would say, in that sense that they didn't play too loud where he could still actually sing, and that he was kind of like had this vulnerable kind of almost neo Brian Wilson-ish thing going on. And then after the show, we talked to him. I think the whole band went and stayed at Matt's house. And I remember he was limping, and he had said he had hurt his foot the night before because they got in a fight in Arizona, which after hearing this music, I was like, these people are pretty well-rounded. Like, to be able to have this beautiful, sweeping, swooping orchestral maneuvers thing going on, and then also to have gotten in some rowdy bar fight, and I assumed that Jason had kicked someone and, like, hurt his foot or something. And we also learned that they were, you know, that Hal Gelb from Giant Sand was at their show, and they were friends with him. So they were, like, kind of these... they kind of had a vagabondish, rough around the edges quality, but had weird clout and attention from higher ups. And then later we also learned that there was some guy there that was associated with Neil Young. By the way, there were probably 30 people at this show, maybe 40, which was pretty typical for that venue. It wasn't huge at all, but they were all pretty intimate, but you're kind of packed in there, pre-COVID, of course. And, there was a guy that was almost like in charge of something for Neil Young, and I don't know if it was like David Briggs or who it was, but he had said, oh, he drove all the way to LA because he had to hear Nebraska. Like, he just had to hear this one song.
If it was just somehow, I'm going to Nebraska. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'll purchase some glasses. Good luck to you all. If there was just somehow.
And I remember feeling like, geez, that's what you need to kind of make it in this business, is for someone to care that much about one song in that way. And I remember feeling a little jealous of that. And I remember feeling a little jealous of their band because they were all skateboarders and had other kind of accoutrements that were well and way outside of the music, when in that day and age it was kind of a nerdy time where it was kind of rejecting rock in some way, like the dumbness of rock, and everyone just seemed like record nerdy then. And our band, we were a pretty cool band, but it was kind of like, once the band got serious musically, the friendships didn't necessarily seem to develop beyond that, which I always found a little disappointing. I kind of wanted like us to be a group of pirates that kept, you know, sailing the seas together. But our personalities didn't mesh, and our band ended up splintering. But Yeah, they left just a total impression on me personally, and I kind of realized that that's what it took to make an interesting band, was to like really include a lot of elements of your life in it. And I think that was kind of formative, because that was before I started my own band. And then that seemed like there were a few things that I picked up that that took me about 15 years to manifest, but now I have a really cool band.
Absolutely.
Of people that get along, and we go in the ocean together. We have similar interests. We tell each other books to read, and I genuinely like them. And then I've never had more fun playing music with people like that, where it's like, if it's a terrible show or if whatever, it's not that youthful thing of like our team has to win the game or today sucks sort of thing. And it feels more like an old country band or something, like, well, that wasn't a good one, you know, but we'll play another show, no problem. So I feel like I picked up so much just from that one night of seeing them, and the romance of that era of actually getting to encounter a band in real life instead of on a device or on a screen or whatever, and the fact that it disappears and it's gone and it leaves you with an empty, aching feeling, not unlike falling in love or like unrequited love more specifically, is probably dying out in a way. Yeah, the impression that it was able to take on me or leave on me with them getting on their horses and riding off into the sunrise the next morning was pretty palpable. And I should mention that I was in a relationship at the time where she wasn't that into the music thing, or like she didn't want to be at shows all the time or whatever. And so I didn't get to hang out after the show. I didn't get the pass to go do that. I had to go spend solo relationship time with my, at that time, girlfriend. But I remember walking past their van, because it was parked in front of so-and-so's house the next morning, and Aaron Birch, the drummer, was asleep on the couch in the van, so he had like slept in the van that night, and I could see him through the windows, shirt off, like sleeping bag and a big old beard, and that was pretty cool. But it was significant, because I'd been around a lot of bands at that point, and this felt like an authentic group of people, like if you saw the Rolling Stones, how they were around each other, you know,
mm-hmm.
in their heyday, just a mystique that wasn't fake or forced, which there's something about Jason's ambition that with so many other people, it would come off as tacky or overly ambitious or whatever. I think his mission was to keep something as personal as was humanly possible and bring it in that state out to as many people as possible without compromising. And I was actually thinking about how much he sort of dared to deal with the devil of like big labels, and that always seemed like such a cool juxtaposition to me with their band, because it was supposed to be unflinchingly honest and just them, and they wouldn't change and they would be in control in that punk way. And I was just thinking about it before we had this conversation, that maybe his aspirations for going pro in skateboarding translated into, well, skate companies aren't that different than record labels, you know. And I'm not afraid of big skate companies, or I think that's cool, you know. So he wouldn't be afraid to try to work with a big record label and try and get it out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was more driven and disciplined early on than anyone I had ever come across in music. Like, I remember a few things stuck with us as a band. He was like, canned spinach is really good on tour. Like, he was like worried about staying healthy on tour. And then so we would be driving as a band and see like a semi with like spinach on the side of it or something. Like, oh, I wonder if they're taking that to Jason. Or like another funny story that he told me was like when smoking was still allowed in clubs in Europe, and they were doing these tours. And I should also mention that they went so headlong into that crazy tour world where you go over to Europe and tour for like a month or 2 months. And he was kind of my canary in the coal mine because I kind of trusted his experience and he would come back. And mind you, I was not one of his closest friends in the world. We stayed in touch over the years, but not like all the time. It was kind of like that friend that you met at summer camp and you guys really hit it off, but you didn't live anywhere near each other. So miraculously you would cross paths here and there. But I remember him just saying how much he hated touring in a way over there. And he hated the indoor smoky venues. And he said, I want to have jumpsuits because your clothes just smell like smoke after you've been in there. It just sucks. He's like, so I want the whole band to just have like mechanics jumpsuits that we wear on stage that we like take off and put our regular clothes back on. And I want to bring cow manure in the back of our amps and just like put it out on stage. Just like, all right, well, you guys are making the air smell like this, so you guys can smell this. Like, this is where we come from. And he's always had a regional pride, like kind of poking fun at where you're from and making that a little transparent, which would the cow manure would qualify as kind of cliche Modesto souvenir.
Going back to Rodriguez, because I know Jason had a role in your LP release, Swing Like a Metronome.
Right.
He recorded it. I think he produced it, I guess, as well, and he played keyboards on it. Can you kind of talk through that process, that timing? How did that come about?
So our band, Rodriguez, was a fantastic live band. We were a trio kind of roughly based on the three groups, Minutemen, Meat Puppets, and Firehose, which Matt and I had seen Firehose a bunch of times because we grew up in Southern California and they would play fairly frequently. And we loved them. We kind of wanted to be our version of Firehose and the Minutemen and play kind of fast and busy and kind of all over the map, not just whatever alternative or punk. We kind of just wanted to embrace a lot of different styles. And Matt was a totally crazily gifted guitar player, and he taught me how to play bass. Essentially, that was kind of my first instrument. I mean, I had to do it with my own fingers, but he showed me the notes and he wrote the bass lines for the first 10 songs of that band at least. And that's a really long story. The problem with that band, as I see it, as I felt it then and as I see it now, is that when you're a great live band and songs get worked out in a practice space and then played out for months or this or that, it's really a little bit hard to then, after they've lived out and oxygen, to capture them in an interesting way in the studio. At least that's how I feel. And so that band was never really represented on record, very interestingly, because by the time it peaked, the music peaked before it was ever documented properly in the studio. And I think it, if we had recorded, we were so green as far as the process went, and as far as like, well, what should we do? Like, should we record ourselves? Or like our first thing was recorded in kind of a commercial studio in a building where this guy could record overnight. And we had to maybe record a whole album in one night or two nights or something. And it wasn't fun. It was super stressful. And we just didn't have direction. So that band really never got captured, but we tried to make the second record, which is the one that Jason recorded the second half of. And we had the record half done with our friend Adam Selzer, who was recording pretty much all of our friends' bands and his own band there at the time in San Luis Obispo. And we had recorded half of the record, and then I believe, like, before the record got finished, Matt was going to move to Chicago and leave the band, and just kind of it was over. And that was, I feel like it was maybe the hardest on me, and I really wanted that band to keep going. And the other two were like, yeah, well, that's what growing up is about, or whatever. I don't know what they were thinking exactly. But I pretty much started, as I knew that band was ending, I started another band called Lincolner with Adam, the guy who'd been recording us, and this woman, Melissa Scales. It was another trio. And we recorded two records like pretty quickly, and it was almost like a breakup band for me to get over that I was losing my main band in a way. And between that time and maybe the following summer, I guess, I think Matt moved away, and then Jason had offered to record us, which Mike Funk was the drummer, and Rodriguez and Matt Ward were both really excited about the fact that Jason wanted to record our record. And to me, the band was done and the band was over, and I didn't really care if the record came out or not. And so when we went to record with Jason, we hadn't played together in a while. To me, it felt like a weird forced reunion. And the original spark was gone for me. And so, unfortunately, I didn't have a great experience recording that. I can still remember that really well, that I felt like I was faking it, and I had already moved on from this band, and it wasn't part of my identity or part of who I was anymore. But we still recorded and played a show with Granddaddy and in Modesto, and slept. I think the three of us slept. There's more funny details. It's not all gloom and doom, but we slept in this basement in Jason at the time's manager's house. They were like refinishing the wood floors. We slept in a basement that was pitch black. I don't know why they felt like we should be down in this basement, in this ladder. It might have been they were pranking us or something, but we slept in this small room together with maybe no light in it. And I remember Jason was living in a little dome tent in the backyard, and there was a swimming pool in the backyard. And I think he would get up and jump in the pool, or he'd jump in the pool, I'm sure, a lot. It was Modesto. It was summertime. It was hot. But I just remember his like swim shorts were hanging up, drying on the tent, on the top of the tent. And he would meet us at the studio. I can't remember what time, but usually we would record at night because it was in an industrial space. So 9 to 5, it was noisy with machines and stuff. So I think we weren't recording till 5 every day, which is also kind of bunk because I'm a morning person. And so we'd be going late into the night, blah, blah, blah. So that's the record you hear. Jason was a fan of mountain biking and going out to the surrounding hills outside of Modesto. He's like, I know this cave. We should record this cave, this song in a cave. And we went there with a portable, I think he had an ADAT maybe recorder. And we recorded a song.
One, two. I was born inside a foundry back in 1893. Found a home inside a hotel that was built beside a stream. And I saw her bathing quietly underneath the willow tree. There were kisses through the window that were carried on the breeze. Well, she'd fill me every morning in her nakedness with lay, singing songs about the water.
But it was just one microphone, press record. I forget who did what, and maybe it didn't sound like it was recorded in a cave, for one, so maybe that was some of his disappointments. Kind of like, sounds better on paper, but if it doesn't actually sound like a cave, who cares? And but to me, that's the tone of that record anyway. Who cares? Like, yes, it was recorded in a cave, but you can't tell. So I don't feel like the music gods were with us anymore. I think they had left that band long before.
Almost sounds like a couple that like wants to get a divorce, but it's just like staying together for the kids until they turn 18, and then they know they're going to be, you know, divorced at that point or whatever.
Absolutely. And I personally, I felt like I was treading the spiritual high ground musically at that point. And I actually thought it was tacky of the other two people in the band that they cared. Like, to me, it didn't matter who wanted to record it, regardless. Like, I was like, it's not going to sound like Granddaddy. Like, why are you excited that Jason wants to record this? It's going to sound like us. We have not been invested in this relationship since the ice storm, like the ice storm movie. But yeah, it was completely like that. But the funniest part of, or the most fateful part of this whole thing was, after the show, I think I left my bandmates, and I think maybe they got their own, I can't remember how we even got to Modesto, if we all traveled together or this or that. But I remember I went to Kevin Garcia, rest in power, his house, I think after the show and after we were done recording. And I think I was like, oh, that was torturous. Like, I just want to record something different. And Kevin's like, I got this 4-track here. And I was like, cool. And it was me and him and this guy, Mike Hart, and maybe one other person. I can't remember if Mike Funk was there. Sorry, Mike. I'm a little blurry on it. There was something on fire in that room that night, that's for sure. But we hit record, and we made what I felt like was supposed to be a scary song. It was like theatrical, almost like that would appear in like a local production of Rocky Horror Picture Show or something. And I remember there was a backwards piano, because he was like, I recorded this piano, let's run it backwards and sing over it, and then we'll put other stuff on it. And we finished that song, and I was like, let's listen to it again. And I was like, let's call our band Little Wings. And they were like, yeah, that's cool. And then we woke up the next morning, and I realized they all lived in Modesto. And I was like, if everyone's okay with it, I'm going to use the band name Little Wings. Just, I'm going to take that, because I came up with it anyway. And they're like, yeah, that's great. And that was, so that dovetailed right from there into like, I need a new band name. I need to get busy working on new stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So from one comes one.
Yeah. So I think if my chronology is somewhat accurate, I think it is. I think Jason must have been working on the Software Slump, on writing it or maybe even recording it at around this time that he's trying to record Swing Like a Metronome with you guys or pushing for that. Is that about right? Is that what you recall?
Great question. I'm thrilled you asked. From what I remember, Under the Western Freeway had just come out. And I don't think he had started on the next record, because I think the next, like I said, I think this was like 19, I think this might have been 1998. Okay. I don't know when he started. Maybe he started already writing the Software Slump.
Slump came out in late 99, so.
The Software Slump?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there's a chance, but I definitely know that Under the Western Freeway was still new.
Mm-hmm.
And his manager at the time, Robbie, would put it on. Push play. We're all in the room, almost like he was still pushing the record, like he couldn't stop pushing the record to everyone in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jason would be like, ugh, like groan, like stop, like don't, kind of like. I remember thinking that was pretty hilarious.
Okay, so another question I had was, on the Twitter project, Jason had kind of mentioned one anecdote that I'd never heard before. I don't think anybody else had heard either. Was that you actually sang kind of backup vocals on Our Dying Brains?
I had kind of forgotten it, and then my friend bought that CD, and then I wasn't credited on it, which I don't care. It's hard to keep track of all that stuff. But my friend was like, I think you're on this track, but I think it was like 2 years later it came out. And how that happened was, I was living in 1999. I was living in my camper shell truck and trying to not pay rent and kind of travel around and just kind of have experiences. And I went and visited Jason for, I think I stayed at his house for like two or three nights at the house that he recorded the Software, no, it would have been after this. Yeah, the Software Slump was already out. But I think it was where he had recorded the Software Slump.
Mm-hmm.
And I might add, and I've brought this up to him since then, I said, this was in 1999, they don't call me the full croc Nostradamus for nothing, but I said, you should make a recording of you just playing piano and singing the songs. And he said, they would like that, wouldn't they? And I said, yeah. And then when he just recently put out the piano only record, I was like, I told you so. It only took you 20 years, but good work.
Yeah.
So I think he had his studio set up at that house. And then he was like, hey, do you want to sing something? I was like, sure. And then we just did it. And it was like 10 minutes.
So you've stayed in touch with Jason over the years. A few years ago in late 2018, you actually had this split release with yourself, Jason, and Kramus all contributing one song that was just an acoustic instrument with no studio tricks. We had spoken with Kramus, and he had said it was kind of his idea. He had been pushing it.
Guy likes to take credit for everything. Listen, but just kidding. No, it was his idea, definitely. Yeah. Go on.
I was just going to ask, what do you remember about that? What was your impression of just the release, I guess? Jason's song, your song, Kremis' song, whatever you want to talk about here.
I was confused until the word thringle came up, and then I knew exactly what was going to happen. It's kind of an adult musical twister, as far as I could understand. That's where we were headed with it. But I was excited. I thought it was really neat. And I think the first thing I heard was Jason's song for it. I think Kremis used that as the bait on the hook. Like, Jason gave me this song. Can you give me a song? And I was like, sure. And then I think I gave him a demo that was going to be on my next record. So I was like, this will be like a single for my record. And so I didn't write a song for it, but then I felt better about my lack of effort when I found out that Jason's song was like a few years old, and it was from when he lived in Portland, Oregon, in an apartment, and maybe after him and his wife had parted ways, and that was kind of the bluesiness of the song. But I remember he recorded it with the either the washer or the dryer going.
The infamous
and
dryer.
Hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked that he said that his apartment smells like an elevator, because I've lived in dorm rooms with that new awful carpet that it's just will always smell like a DuPont factory. And it really is depressing.
I'm doing some laundry right now. That's why you can hear the dryer in the background. Well, guess what? I've got a new house. It's not that much. It's kind of on the outskirts. But on a good day, it's the color of dirt. And it smells just like an elevator.
All right, let's get to Jason's song that you picked.
I would say that I could just throw a stone. For me, ranking songs is not really something I'm totally into, because it's all subjective and it's impossible to prove that one song is actually better than the other. But for me, I kind of wanted to rank this song, for me personally, AM180. I was living at my dad's house at the time, and I got an advanced cassette. He made a cassette copy of Under the Western Freeway before it came out and sent it to me. And I had, I think I just had a tape player in my car still then. This would have been 1997-ish or something. And I must have had a Walkman in my bedroom. And so I remember putting that record on, and it starts out with Non-Phenomenal Lineage, which is really subdued, pretty and melancholic little number. And I just remember, first off, and I know we're not talking about this song, but first off, I just loved how that record started kind of so intimately, and then it just blasts into the second song, which the first time ever hearing it did send literal, you know, chills and goosebumps and adrenaline and whatever that whole cocktail is through my system. And I remember just laying there, you know, before bed listening to music, which I'd been doing since I was in fifth grade when I first got my first Walkman for my birthday by my own request. That was like kind of my deal, was like put on a Walkman, lights out, fall asleep listening to music. Not so much. I would be focused, and then I had a friend that would like put on music and fall asleep, and I'd be like, what are you doing? Like, turn it, like, hit stop, like, don't fall asleep to music. Like, when you're getting tired, hit stop, because I don't know, I like to sleep in silence. But I remember hearing that song and it just jolting me in a really exciting way. The keyboard's so bloop, 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 like so bloopy and out of time, kind of just seems like an invention. And then the theme of the song at that time, I felt there was more like maybe the contemporary would be like Sebado, or which is, there's a huge gap, I feel, but there was like lots of white boy self-deprecation about breakup songs and self-doubt and kind of like, if you ever decide you want me again, and that sort of longing. But this one was different because it was high energy and it was a pleading kind of like, almost like Help Me Rhonda, Beach Boys, but like he wanted to get back together with the girl. And you don't know why they're not together. But his insistence and persistence and his convincing makes you think maybe he did something to mess it up, or it could just be the classic heartbreak song where he got dumped and then he's just putting it all on the line, just like, please, like baby, come back, you know? So, to have all those things overlaid, like a really high energy song and with actually kind of funny lyrics that would perhaps charm someone into like, well, he's pretty funny. Like, he's a pretty funny guy. Like, he's this new football player guy doesn't even have a sense of humor. Like, you know, and here's this weirdo guy that made, which I, for all I know, knowing him, he did make this song to get a person back in his life. Do you know what I mean? That's the other thing.
Right.
I think that as far as like authenticity goes, is I could be wrong, but I get the sense that his humility is as such that he would see the benefit of actually making a song that's like, quote, bitchin', that would, could win someone back. Just, you know, yep, that's the song that got her back. Now they have four kids. Like, kind of like, he would see that as a positive of, like, the power of music. And I felt like there's just, like, an underdog-ness there. I wrote earlier today. That there's something about striving to get the relationship back together. He probably messed up, but leaves that out in a sly, formulaic way that probably invisibly points back at himself. To me, Jason had a beyond his years wisdom and self-deprecation that wasn't quite in vogue at that time in that sort of music. I'm quoting myself again here. Sure, there was straight self-doubt rampant, but his had a light in the tunnel, something to try for kind of feeling. The slacker 90s were like trying as uncool, but there remained some innocence in our narrator, a wide-eyedness that knew effort would be rewarded.
Things important to us, like whatever. We'll defuse bombs, walk marathons, and take on whatever together.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think, like, his earlier songs were a lot more metaphoric in terms of his own, you know, feelings being projected through the songs. But then obviously as he's gone later and later, he's just become even more vulnerable. I mean, his last album was almost, you know, had these songs about this painful, painful divorce, obviously. And,
yeah,
really tears at your heart. And, you know, I know some of those songs, and maybe this one, like you mentioned, have, you know, very autobiographical feel to them, but it's very subtle in a way that leaves the listener kind of wondering.
For sure, which is what good art is, because the listener can put themselves in that position. As you were saying that, I was remembering that at the time I was in a stable relationship with a girl, but that song made me wish maybe we were broken up for a second so I could try and get her back. I wanted to be the narrator, kind of like when you see a movie as a kid. I would always run into my room and piece together a costume that was kind of like the character, the protagonist on the screen, to kind of like, me too, right, guys? Kind of like dress up like. But
there is
something about the protagonist and the protagonist that he puts forward is very human and very relatable.
There it is. Special thanks to Kyle Field for being so generous with his time. Even after talking to me about Jason for over an hour, we spent another 15 minutes talking about David Berman and other random things. I haven't even mentioned my burgeoning love of Little Wings yet, but I've already taken a deep dive into their back catalog, and I keep going back for more. They have such a unique sound, such clever lyrics. I'm all in. We're going to finish this episode off with my favorite, Fat Chance by Little Wings. Speak with all of you again in 2 weeks.
Yeah. said he certified chance type man. Smacking that ball, you don't dance. Cut a road with scissors. Snow and hell, there's no chance. Armstrong like Lance. Beach rat short pants. Need water deep rant. Cut into a cactus. Big fish jaws six. Tooth fairy make a wish. Num num flying brick. Nate pump too sick. Octopus, eight arms, booby traps, salons, 360 full spin, garbage plant, climbing, green grouch morning, red alert warning, bloodshot blazing, free flag waving, pencil ruler, shredder dueler, look at that light wolf that chains, ride a rainbow with no hands, donut, bear paw, bagel and lox. Yeah, rock, flavored coffee, caramel toffee, Mississippi's candies, peppermint patties, Andes, mint, green mint chip, shred, claw, tear, rip, Wolverine, Maybelline, dry those tears, Mr. Clean, wet, wipe, wet, nap, applause, clap, clap, plush, toy, stuff, you, bar, bar, and poo, fat, chance, slim, gin. Oxygen, popcorn, peanuts, kitty weenus, dentine tried it, bent their pride it, been there, done that, pork, dart, ball, bat, fat, chance, worm, stance, worm, worm, ant, ant, pet, ant, wash him, please don't squash him, hi-ho, silver, horse, bath, filler, up, sun, wash, tub, setting sun, true kiss, do this, only one way to get through this, A-bomb, Ray-Ban, I rock, I ran, I jog, I jam, Superman, Peter Bandon, but him never blasting me, him never tried, him never blasted me.